We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program. We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge and American Concierge magazines. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and a business and shopping guide. Concierge magazines are distributed throughout Central Illinois and always present the Champaign-Urbana and Bloomington-Normal areas at their best.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is on the controls now for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. In this hour, we'll be talking about nuclear power. We'll return to the subject. We've certainly discussed it before, and indeed we were talking about it earlier this week. There are many people who make the argument that if the United States is going to meet its need for energy and at the same time dealing with the problem of carbon emissions, that nuclear power will have to be part of the solution. Now, of course, there are other people who make a different argument. They say that nuclear power has too many negatives, among them the very high cost of plant construction and also the need to dispose of highly radioactive waste. Earlier in the week, on Tuesday, we had as a guest here James Stubbins, who's head of the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering here at the University of Illinois, someone who definitely believes in the potential of nuclear generation. And we talked about some of the basic questions. Well, we wanted to do that again today with a guest who has a different point of view. And we have with us, joining us by phone, Dr. Jordan Weaver. He works at the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C. He works in support of their efforts in oversight and public involvement on emerging technologies regarding their safety and economic risk. He has a background in physics. He has a degree in physics from Louisiana State University and also a doctorate in nuclear engineering from the University of Texas at Austin. He recently began work as project scientist and science center fellow at the NRDC in Washington. Before that, his research was focused on non-proliferation and nuclear forensics through developing technologies that improve nuclear explosion monitoring methods and also environmental sampling. And that is indeed suggests one of the other issues that people have with nuclear power, and that is the connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. So this is some of the ground we'll try to cover this morning, and questions are welcome, as always. We hope people will try to be brief and on target with their questions, but if you can do that, you're certainly welcome to call. We just like to get in as many different people as possible. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So if it would be long distance, use that number. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that too. The address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, if you have questions for us, you can give us a call. And Dr. Weaver, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks
good.
For having me on.
Good. Well, thanks for giving us some of your time. Well, I guess as a general question, I wonder how it is that you think about that the basic argument that I laid out there just in introducing the subject, and that is that there are some people who will say, we have this tremendous need for energy. We have concerns about the environmental impact of using fossil fuels. So they will say that if we want to meet our energy and deal with this carbon problem, then nuclear generation, it's going to have to be. That's what they would say, I'm sure. It will have to be part of the picture. What do you think?
I would say that on a certain degree, we agree with that here at NRDC. But, you know, the events in Japan have kind of cast new things in the light. And so some of the important things that we need to know or start thinking about in terms of nuclear power post-Fukushima are how do we make our existing nuclear power plants as safe as we can, in addition to making them as environmentally sound as we possibly can. And you know, are they economically feasible? And what Fukushima showed us is there are risks and vulnerabilities in all three of these areas, so we have some work to do.
Mm. Well, so you would then, I'm sure that there would be people who would say that nuclear power is unredeemable, and that there would be other people who would say, well, it is certainly it presents some serious technological challenges, but that they would say those challenges can be met. That doesn't mean that it's going to be easy, but those challenges can be met. So is it, do I understand that you would be one of those who would say that while difficult, that it's possible to deal with, for example, the issue of reliability, safety, and waste?
I believe it is possible to deal with this issue. Now, to what extent we're seeing that in the United States, that's a large question right now. We've just received the NRC has commissioned a task force report that was a kind of initial step, just kind of looking at what happened. You know, what do we need to start to address in terms of lessons learned from Fukushima? And we've kind of been seeing an interesting dynamic playing out, and how they're planning to deal with these recommendations. So,
well, let's talk about Fukushima, because certainly after that occurred, as people I'm sure will remember, there was an earthquake and a tsunami in March. It struck Japan. It damaged several nuclear reactors there, and that it required an evacuation of a large area around the plant. The company that owns those plants is still working on bringing them under control, and they say now maybe they think by the end of the year. Overall, some people think that it would take maybe 10 years, maybe more, to achieve some cleanup. And in fact, there are some people who argue that the folks who had been living there in that area may never go back, that nobody may ever be able to live there. It maybe would be a long time. And so looking at that, though, then some people have said, well, that's Japan is Japan, U.S. is U.S. We're not going to have a tsunami here, or we're not going to have one inland. So the whole issues of dealing with a natural disaster like that are different. What do you think is the takeaway for the United States of Fukushima?
Well, there are a number of features of plants in Japan that are very similar to some in the U.S. And while the regulatory process in Japan is probably quite different from the U.S. process, we did see certain things that kind of seem to be related to issues that could arise in the United States. You know, while these events are highly improbable, and the NRC's kind of regulations are based on these risk-based analyses and defense in depth. But the fact of the matter is that improbable events still do happen, and it may not be a tsunami, but we have to consider universal risks that were presented in Fukushima that we would probably need to address. And of those are, we saw a serious problem concerning AC power required to keep the plant running and cooling, or keep the plant at least cooling its reactor core. So, mm-hmm. And also, monitoring and the operation of things from the control room, things like that. These are all event things that kind of seem to be just very big problems in Japan that we should probably address here in the United States. Because as some people may not know, but in the United States there are 23 Mark I reactors, and that's the type of reactor that seemed to have the most problems in Japan. There's four of them actually in Illinois at the Dresden and Quad Cities location.
Mm-hmm.
But they in addition to the Mark II reactor, they have a very small containment, and so that that's kind of where, you know, that these are some of the things that we're trying to address in engaging with the NRC as to how they move forward and what are the really pertinent issues that need to be addressed soon. So,
mm-hmm. Well, that, just to make sure people understand that it's my understanding that in Japan that the shutdown of the reactors worked as it should have, worked fine. But the problem is that the fuel stays very hot for a long time. So what you need to be able to do is your cooling system that cools the reactor and cools the fuel has to keep working. And there it would seem that what happened was that there was emergency backup power for that, but it got it got destroyed one way or another by the tsunami, and so it no electricity means you can't run your cooling systems. Your plant overheats, you got a problem. Do we really? Are there many places in the United States where the idea of well, what would happen if the plant would lose power would be a big problem?
I wouldn't say that right now we have there are huge problems. The real problem we have is regulatory oversight in some of these defense systems that are, in a way, patchwork in how they are implemented across from one site to the next. And so certain plants address them in different manners, and there's no, in some cases, they're not very standardized as to how they go about providing this defense in depth. So you were right in that in Japan, you know, the tsunami and the flooding of the rooms that should have, in hindsight, would have been much more useful if they had been protected against, flooding that, that maybe they didn't expect. But this is something that, that isn't a high, there's not a, I guess, a requirement in place on some of these issues, and so within the U.S. And so we kind of, while many sites do address this problem of having backup diesel generators, the reliability and the security of these systems in the event of a highly unlikely but possibly very damaging accident.
Mm-hmm. We certainly there are places in the United States that do experience earthquakes, and we just had one on the East Coast the other day, and there were some nuclear plants that were affected, at least in the sense that there were shutdowns. So you have to consider that yes, there would be places where there might be the possibility of an earthquake affecting the plant operation. Are there in fact many plants in the United States that are located around fault zones?
There are a number of them. I would say there are some San Onofre plant in California, as well as another one in California. There are some on the eastern coast that are near fault lines, and so we obviously the North Anna plant, which was one that kind of recently received a lot of news attention over it shutting down after the recent earthquake. But in the North Anna case, it shut down, as you said, like it should, in the event. They lost off-site power, and their diesel generators kicked in and picked up the slack, but one of their diesel generators did fail. So that was one of four, and I believe they got it working again eventually. But these types of failures of these backup systems happen regularly enough that, we feel that there should probably be a further oversight in this. Mm-hmm.
That just means that someone needs to be someone outside of the company and the people that operate this plant needs to do periodic inspections just to check to make sure that everything is working as it should.
Absolutely, a large part of the task force report, the NRC task force report on what we should do, involved the concept of these voluntary initiatives that are sometimes taken by the industry. So there are lots of requirements in place, but they don't necessarily get implemented in the same way. And so in the place, some aspects of safety get handled through these, or emergency planning, I should say, get handled through these voluntary initiatives on the industry's part. So they don't necessarily have a standardized method for dealing with a lot of these. And so, but that they are, as far as the NRC's role in trying to, do walkdowns and inspections and at least having a standard by which to gauge a plant's reliability in such an accident, I think that there needs to be some work done in that aspect. So.
Our guest in this hour is Jordan Weaver. He is someone who has background in physics and nuclear engineering. He recently began work as a project scientist and science center fellow at the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C. He works in their nuclear program. And we're talking here this morning about nuclear power, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And if you have a question that you'd like to send by email, well, you can certainly do that too by writing us at will-talk at illinois.edu. It's been quite a long time since anybody really undertook to build a new plant, or at least maybe there have been some initial efforts, but in terms of when the last time a new plant actually went online was, it's been quite a long time. Now, it seemed that the country was inching closer to trying to revive this industry, or at least people argued that it should, and now, though Fukushima tends to have set that back some, But it seems that the big problem is that it is incredibly expensive to build a nuclear power plant. It takes a long time. It's very expensive. It's very complicated. And that it's a risk that people just don't want to take. And I suppose some people also would argue that, well, that has to do with the way we design and build the plants, and that there's no reason we couldn't build a reliable and simpler plant that would also be less expensive. I mean, what do you think about the issue of plant design and whether it would be possible to achieve something that would be more affordable? I'm sure it would still be expensive, but it would be more affordable than what we're doing now.
I think that effort is in the right place as far as in terms of safety and the economics. It's, you know, anytime you standardize and kind of consolidate a lot of these features to where you can make the licensing and the verification of these systems easier, obviously this is going to reduce time, and which feeds a lot into the overall cost. These take a while, and the upfront investment is very large. But a lot of people now after the accident are saying, you know, we have these plants on these Generation 3 Plus plants that are, you know, supposedly, or Generation 3 and 3 Plus plants that are safer. They have all these new features, and they want to start building really quickly, or they ask, why aren't we building these sooner and faster? And these are plants that are essentially a case not proven. It's not that they aren't taking into account some of these safety improvements, but, you know, the NRDC, we accept that it's reasonable that that the nuclear industry would need to build some of these new plants to take up to take up new energy requirements. But, there's plans to subsidize, five different types of plants. And we kind of think that's a little outrageous considering when you start talking about them penetrating the U.S. market without any proven case. And so, and it also kind of undermines the whole idea of standardization, so it's not really in line with the nuclear renaissance objective of making this easier. So we have kind of differing views on where it should, how it should be played out over the next, in the near term. So,
well, would I don't know if such a thing would be achievable, but would it make sense for scientists and nuclear engineers and everybody to get together and sit down and say, okay, let's design the best plant, and we'll have one design, and everybody will build the same one, and that, you know, that way we'll get the best that we possibly can. I'm not sure that such a thing is even possible, though.
Well, it sounds like a definite good idea. I would imagine that, you know, like if everything worked well, if we got a way, that would probably be how we'd like to see it happen, or at least some people would. But the industry will push back on that. You know, it's not as simple as just designing the best plant, because at some point cost does factor in. And so at what level do you say, too much, this is the acceptable amount of risk in these different aspects of the plant? And so building the best possible plant, I think, would prove to be very expensive, prohibitively expensive in comparison with other, like to where it is, you know, 100% absolutely, it looks great across all fronts. So
would there even be agreement? Say we get a bunch of nuclear engineers together, would there be even agreement on what the best, what quote-unquote the best possible plant would look like?
I don't know. That's a very interesting question. I'm not exactly sure. There, even within the nuclear engineering community, different scientists have different opinions on what does make the best reactor in terms of overall efficiency or overall safety. I think that, you know, the industry is working towards that. I think that they're at least trying to address some of these issues and improve on previous reactor designs. But to what extent they're improving, that still remains to be seen. So.
All right. Let's talk with a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Good to hear this topic being addressed. I'm not sure within the business climate in the United States if you can ever create a plant that is truly safe, nor do I imagine there would ever be a regulatory commission that would follow through to the extent that was necessary. I'm not 100% opposed to nuclear power, but it doesn't seem to me we have discovered anything that even approximates safety and reliability, even accepting there can't be any complete guarantees. I would like you to address the fact that listening to the fallout, as it were, from the earthquake in Virginia the other day, where I've heard scientists state that they don't even really know that the fault line had existed previously and how it will affect. It seems to me, I guess I'd like you to explore some of the hidden risks that may never be knowable within the next 20, 30 years, and also what we are to do with the storage issue. Apparently, we are now to acquire contaminated storage that will be placed over the Mahomet Aquifer in the Clinton landfill area, and that's another absolutely appalling thought to which not many people seem to be giving too much attention. So I'm going to hang up and just listen, but I am very glad this is being discussed in a reasonable manner. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Right, thank you. Well, I don't know how you want to tackle that.
Yeah.
We could talk some more maybe about plant safety and what really that means. I mean, what are the risks? What is it the thing that plant designers and operators are most concerned about?
Well, there are a couple things. I guess in terms of what we've seen recently and what is getting a lot more attention is the concept of seismic risk and the vulnerability of the system in the event of a station blackout. So that these are many different natural phenomena can contribute to this particular event, but what really happens is in the event you have something like a prolonged station blackout where they're now relying on backup power sources. That is a large risk that they're assessing at this point, which is, what is considered a decent coping time? How long do we need to be able to stay on backup power systems before we can maybe bring the system back up to where it can now operate on AC power or have on-site power actually? So. Some of the other risks that we're looking at are, some of the big ones are when you have this loss of coolant accident, which is essentially, the inability to either losing the actual coolant surrounding the core or the inability to actually continue to cool it and the water just continues to heat and pressure builds up. So how do you go about mitigating the effects of these incidents? And one possibility is one of the recommendations from the task force was the installation of these hardened, reliable hardened vents, these wet well vents that kind of are in the event that the pressures exceed what you would like, you would like to be able to maybe vent some of, in a controlled manner, some of the pressure and as well some radiation. But the problem is there's not a lot known about what came out of Japan in that instance when they lost power and how reliable were these vents and were they actually ever able to vent some of them. So that there's been a lot of attention into how should we address that. In the United States, there are, with all the Mark I reactors that could possibly fall victim to the situation, as we saw in Japan, they do have reliable hardened vents. But as I mentioned, this was one of the industry initiatives that was kind of, that the NRC had some oversight in, but didn't actually require any of the Mark II, which only have maybe a 25% larger containment volume. So it's not hard to believe that, an event like this would also occur in a Mark II containment. And of those, there are, I believe, 23, maybe like 9 Mark II reactors. And so this is something that I think, or excuse me, 8. And of the 8, 5 have these vents. But there is no, regulatory process that goes about standardizing what constitutes a reliable vent, the ability to run when you don't have power, AC power to control some parts of these venting systems, or in any case being able to actually monitor the pressures from the control room or operate these vents from the control room. So these are definitely some of the risks that they're going about. So.
Well, it should isn't there a way, or I would think that there should be a way that you could design a system that would continue to cool the reactor that would not rely on external power. I mean, is such a thing even possible?
Yes. Well, I'm not exactly sure on the details of which reactors, but there are certain ones that deal with. So I think some of the newer reactor designs are entertaining these ideas of, these physics-driven mm-hmm. as opposed to, operator involvement, mm-hmm. so these passive safety systems. And There are, in two terms, one is the cooling water. There are these, I think in the AP1000 has a gravity-fed refilling of the containment vessels, or of the reactor core of coolant. So, but then we also have other things, like in relation to these vents, there are designs that involve passive containment venting with ruptured disks that kind of like once you get to a certain point, no one has to go in and release the pressure themselves manually or even from the control room. They just give, and you hopefully that you have installed some kind of AC independent isolation valve to like essentially reestablish containment so you're not leaking further radiation. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, just again, it's my understanding that the kind of reactors we're talking about here, these boiling water reactors, what we're doing here is we're the nuclear reaction, the nuclear fission makes heat. The heat heats water, turns to steam. Steam turns a turbine, generates electricity. Then we can take that steam and condense it again back to water, and we can make that a loop. We can have that be a closed loop. And the problem is if the reactor gets and that this happens inside the it's like a closed bottle that the steam and the reactor are inside the bottle. Though the if the heating gets out of control, it gets too hot, the steam builds up. Well, you can vent the steam off so that it doesn't blow up the bottle. But then if you run out of coolant, if your water supply runs out, then you got a problem. How do you make sure that you have a continuous supply of water, or is that not particularly an issue?
No, I think having a continuous supply of water is definitely, you need to have, more importantly, you need to have a way to continually reuse the water. Mm-hmm. And so that is where the idea behind these backup systems for powering the pumps come into play. And, so one would say that these passive systems where you have external reserve sources of water that are possibly gravity fed would help to alleviate that cost. But yes, there are within certain reactor designs, especially these boiling water reactor designs, yeah, you are correct in that this whole system is very closed, and you have to have a method by which to, mitigate any kind of unforeseen circumstance where you start to build up large pressures and large amounts, any like possible loss of coolant. And so that being the real danger is actually losing the coolant and not being able to supply it with coolant. We saw this in Japan where after a loss of coolant, there was bringing in tons of, seawater to kind of try to help with this issue. So,
Well, we're talking in this hour of Focus about nuclear power, and our guest for the program is Jordan Weaver. He is a nuclear engineer by his academic training, has a degree from the University of Texas, Austin. He works as a project scientist and science center fellow at the Natural Resources Defense Council with their nuclear program located in Washington, D.C. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Tom Perata, the author of the novels Election and Little Children, which were both adapted into films. His new novel, The Leftovers, is about the people left behind grieving after many people from their town instantaneously disappear in what may or may not be the rapture. Perata is working on an HBO adaptation of the novel. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, whose 28th season explores music, solemn and frolicsome, from 18th century Mozart to 21st century composers, and celebrates live music with performances by the U of I Chorale and Women's Glee Club. More information is available at 333-6280.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. We're here during the morning, 10 to noon, Monday through Friday, and we have different topics every day. Tomorrow morning on the show, in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk with David Reynolds. He's professor of English and American Studies at City University of New York and is author of a recent book that looks at Uncle Tom's Cabin and the impact that that book and its author had on America and the way people thought about slavery. Mightier Than the Sword is the title, and that's what we'll do tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour. In the 11 o'clock, we'll have some more of our 30th anniversary archives, things that we've been doing here to celebrate the fact that this show has been on the air 30 years. We've been going back to our tape archive for some old programs that have not been heard in a long time. And you'll hear a couple of shows tomorrow from the early 90s. In the first hour, Peter Arnett, who became pretty famous and some people would say infamous for having reported from Baghdad during the first Gulf War. We talked with him some time ago about his experiences as that and other experiences that he's had as a reporter. And then George Roeder, who was for a long time professor at the Art Institute of Chicago, talks about how it is that the U.S. government tried to control the images that people in the country got during World War II. So that's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon. You can check out the schedule by going to the website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour of focus, we're talking about nuclear power, and our guest is Jordan Weaver. He is a project scientist and Science Center fellow at the Natural Resources Defense Council within their nuclear program, located in Washington, D.C., and is interested in a number of things, particularly nuclear proliferation or non-proliferation, that is, the effort to stop the spread of nuclear weapons, something that certainly in a lot of people's minds connects very much with nuclear power. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also email a question if you would like. Send it to will-talk at illinois.edu. And we do have another caller to bring into the conversation, someone who is listening this morning in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The previous caller brought up a point that I would like to emphasize. She mentioned that apparently nobody knew that a fault existed in the area that the earthquake took place recently in the eastern United States. I feel that that's a very good point because we seem to be putting a lot of money in technologies that will take care of issues after they happen, but hardly anybody is putting any money in studying the geology that would have given a clue on what's down there and prevented a lot of damage that could potentially happen. It seems to be a prevalent mode of thinking that we would rather take care of problems that arise with some technology rather than looking and investing the same or less amount of money in more pedestrian-looking steps. Another example of this is coal-burning power plants that could be re-equipped to make gas out of coal and increase the efficiency of power plants by almost a third in a very safe manner. But we seem to be worried about taking care of the carbon once it is out in the thing. So I'd like to draw attention to that and see what your guest has to say to that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Dr. Weaver?
So in terms of determining what existing risk in a site before, you know, that comes out, we hope, in the licensing process when a possible utility or plant owner group decides to build a plant. They put in an application, and there is an evaluation of, you know, historic seismic activity in the region, and depending on the level of risk will determine either, you know, is the site suitable or what level of protections are then going to be mandated on the site. So, but as far as to you know, how much effort, I'm not exactly sure as to what the spread is pre-planning for these types of things as opposed to making sure that if in the event something did happen, you're able to help. I like to think that they spend enough in both aspects, but as far as whether or not the fault line was known, I haven't heard anything about that. But this is a topic that is being brought up within the task force recommendations on site suitability, and there are certain one of the recommendations is for plant licensees to go and reassess and reevaluate what are, you know, the new seismic risks in for their site. In light of, you know, some of these haven't been done in a very long time, and trying to reevaluate, you know, are our protections adequate? And that was kind of a big point for the task force. And they also recommended doing walkdowns to identify any seismic or flood vulnerabilities in a plant. And so this is the fact that they're suggesting this seems to, or maybe increase in the walkdowns, but the fact that they're suggesting it. Seems that, you know, that they're recognizing a safety gap that needs to be filled, and that we need to do further study of a site, or determine what a site's, you know, vulnerabilities are concerning seismic and flood.
All right. Well, I thank the caller. Let's go to Champagne for somebody else here. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I'm a geologist for the State Geological Survey, and one of the problems we have is obviously about lack of knowledge. I've heard several people say that the earthquake in the East Coast recently did not occur near a fault. Well, I can tell you that it occurred near the Lakeside Fault or the Spotsylvania Faults in Virginia. And I knew that within 24 hours of the earthquake taking place. So I think people just think that, though there's no fault there, well, they need to look at the details. And they tend to make conclusions without those facts.
Well, let me ask you, since you have the background, was the existence of these faults known?
They're on maps. I have a map right in front of me.
Okay, so it's not a case that someone could come along and say, well, we didn't know that, you know, we didn't know they were there. They were known to be there.
They're known to be there, and there are other faults in the area. This is certainly the largest one in that area.
Mm-hmm.
But there was some small faults in the 3 to 3.9 scale on the Spotsylvania, and one on the Lakeside Fault, too. I don't know the dates on those, but there's actually lots of faults in those areas. I think what was known is it was not known for sure where the earthquake was, and they sort of guessed, okay, there was no fault there.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Okay. Well, thanks for the information.
Yeah, thank you.
I really appreciate it. And again, other questions, welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, there's another big piece here that I want to make sure we talk at least a little bit about, that is the problem of waste, high-level radioactive waste. We here in the United States had been engaged in a long process. The federal government had been engaged in a very long process going back to late 1970s to develop a storage site for high-level waste produced by commercial nuclear power plants. There's a whole separate system for the military and the waste that's been produced by making atomic weapons. This is different. This is just for what comes from commercial power plants. And the hope was by this time it would be running, up and running. And it had a long and tortured history, and it apparently is now Yucca Mountain is not going to happen, and something we have to find something else, and the waste is being stored currently on site at power plants. Again, here, I wonder what you think about this problem of waste, and whether also you and the NRDC thinks of this as a solvable problem.
At NRDC, in respect to Yucca Mountain or the concept of a permanent geologic repository, we are supportive. We think that is the best way to handle the waste. So we're not. We do think that the waste should be manageable through that effort. Our main contention with the Yucca Mountain site was just over the process and the setting of radiation standards. It seemed that, you know, when a problem occurred with the site, the standards were relaxed, and there are a host of technical and political controversies all surrounding this, and you know, at the time it got canceled, these didn't seem like they were going away anytime soon, and so, and this was what I think led, you know, President Obama to set up this Blue Ribbon Commission, which is one of their goals was to determine where do we go next with the process of siting a repository or even, you know, determining what that means politically. So
mm-hmm.
I think one of their suggestions was, you know, that the repository effort should definitely learn from the previous approach and make an effort to engage more meaningfully with the public, and as well as the involved governments, local, state, and tribal governments that are associated with potential sites, and to kind of increase this transparency and the communication between all the interested stakeholders in this, be it the public or the industry.
Well, just to make sure that I understand, is it the position of the NRDC that this was a good site or a bad site? I mean, do you have issues with the site itself, or was it that what concerns you most is the whole process about how it was developed?
I think within the NRDC, the larger part of our contention was basically over the process and the public involvement. Mm-hmm. That seemed to overall, taint the perception of what the repository means to the local people or the United States. And so that was kind of the difficulty in going forward with this, and it kind of just reached a stalemate toward the end. You know, they got to the point where they were beginning the licensing process was just really starting to get underway, and so it was it was an unfortunate waste of money up until that if this happens this way, but that doesn't negate the fact that there should be improvements on reconciling some of these issues that are raised by the state and how the site is selected in particular. It seemed that originally I believe it was 5 sites were supposed to be for the first, there's supposed to be originally 2 repository sites to be built, and 5 were going to be recommended for the first to the president, and he would make a decision on, or 5 would be chosen, 3 would be recommended, and 1 would be picked, and then an additional process for the second repository. But at various points, they kind of short-circuited some of those aspects of that selection process and just kind of went straight with Yucca Mountain. And so it kind of makes one wonder, with the Yucca Mountain site, did they kind of paint themselves into a corner, and that they had to make this site work at that point, and that was that just lended itself to more controversy. So,
and do you think that it would be possible to find a site that would be both suitable, technically suitable, and also would be one where the people, whoever was living there, would be okay with having it?
I'm not sure exactly how that's going to play out, but the BRC, the Blue River Commission, is hopeful, and they are using a lot of. They're putting up enough examples, at least from between other countries that are used slightly different approaches to citing these repositories, and they've seen notably more success than we have in the United States. So, I think I'm hopeful that through the appropriate amount of public engagement, public involvement, and I think the technical rigor is definitely there that we could definitely find a site, but. It would just, that's a process I think that's going to have to play out over the next couple. Within the BRC has some good points on this. So I think that if anyone's interested, they just released their draft report, which I believe is open for public comment. So.
All right. We have about 7-8 minutes left. We have some other callers. Piatone is next in line. That's line number 1. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I'd say the major problem is going to be, the major sticking point is going to be like you brought up earlier, Dave, is the fact that where are you going to put it? And the people anywhere, they don't like the fact that you're going to have nuclear waste of any kind in my backyard. We all know what the afterlife is, and I think that's a big concern. I mean, we've stockpiled all this stuff, and it's just dripping and leaking. I've seen pictures of what the horrendous looks of these drums and things leaking, and having come from an area back out west in Nevada, everybody out there is saying the same thing. Why can't we recycle? There's a lot of information and technology that Europe and Germany and all those people are using. It seems like we're lacking some of that, and I think we're going to have to do more recycling and more figuring out how to maybe reduce the shelf life on it, so to speak, because it is inherently dangerous. I mean, even, I don't know why people think that nuclear power plants are safe. They're not. you know, it's either you deal with the smoke coming out of chimneys or you deal with the waste, which is, to me, far worse than the smoke coming out of chimneys because it's like a 10,000-year life. And if we contaminate our groundwater, which is starting to happen out in places like Victor Valley, Apple Valley, Barstow, you know, where there was a movie made about it. That should explain something. We got to learn from our mistakes, and we're not doing that. I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. And there's one thing, I guess, Dr. Weaver, I really want to have you respond to, and that is the issue of reprocessing. And I think that some people have said, well, we could at least reduce the waste that we have to store by doing that, and then we get something that we can reuse. And you take the spent fuel, you reprocess, you separate out some stuff that you really do have to store, and then you get something that you can put back in the reactor. And I think that maybe the chief argument that people have made against reprocessing does indeed have to do with something else that we really haven't talked about, but I know it's an issue that concerns you and the NRDC, and that is the spread of nuclear weapons. Do you have a problem with the idea of reprocessing waste?
Personally, coming from a nuclear engineering background, you know, the reprocessing is kind of, I would say, generally considered, if we can get it to be both economically feasible and commercially viable and proven, it's definitely the holy grail in some aspects. But the problem is that, you know, there's a few things. You mentioned the proliferation risk, but first I'll talk about, you know, that just economically, it's not proven, and the current price on uranium doesn't lend itself to making reprocessing an economic process at the moment. Mm. And in terms of, you know, a decarbonization effort, it just creates a huge tax on that effort because it doesn't really produce any extra electricity with an enormous cost on the overall fuel cycle. And while, you know, there are some arguments, and I believe some of them, in that, you know, there is an impact, you can reduce the impact on, say, what your future repository would be, and as your caller mentioned, you know, reducing the shelf life, you know, the half-life, some of these longer-lived isotopes, if you can work on reducing that. But one thing that I guess is not being addressed enough, we think, for it to be, you know, introduced on a commercial sense, is the overall aspect of the environment, the overall impact you have from the waste streams that are produced. And in addition, any expansion of these facilities would entail some proliferation concerns. And so there needs to be a more robust system for controlling those proliferation risks before we actually put in the system. You know, the construction of these control systems should definitely precede the actual implementation of any reprocessing scheme.
So we have the problem that you have something that's highly toxic you don't want in the environment. You have the problem that somewhere here you're producing something that could be used to make a nuclear weapon. But also it sounds as if you're saying that on top of all that, it's cheaper to go out and dig up some new uranium and enrich that for fuel than it is to reprocess. Is that am I getting that right?
In essence, yes. I mean, at the moment, large-scale reprocessing, it has been shown in, you know, in Europe, and certain they do use this to some degree. But as far as it being, you know, economically viable in the United States, I'm not really sure. I don't think it's there. There are a lot of, you know, technological leaps that need to happen. And so I understand the need for further research possibly into mm-hmm. this, but until, you know, that jump is made, you know, this could be 10 to 20 years off. And so we still are left with a very large, a very decent amount of waste that we have to handle, and we kind of fill a repository as a more realistic approach at this moment. Right. And that is also the conclusion of the more or less of the Blue Ribbon Commission. They didn't really touch a whole lot on whether or not, as policy, the U.S. should go towards reprocessing, but they did lay out some of the benefits and setbacks to this, and as far as in terms of proliferation, economic scalability, and all this. So,
okay. Well, we're getting short on time. I have one more caller I want to try to get in on a cell phone, line 4. Hello.
Hi. This is a question about the cost. I was just curious about what the cost is of, you know, say, one of the 20 most likely to be built plants, you know, would be, and how much of that gets subsidized, and whether it's worth it, what the payoff is.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not exactly sure as far as the, you know, the cost. I mean, the cost is in the, you know, billions of dollars, and it depends on the time frame as to which they expect these to be built. But As far as the subsidies are concerned, there are a number that we kind of don't really agree with. There is, you know, the one we mentioned. I think you believe you mentioned on someone brought up on your Tuesday show was the, you know, Price-Anderson cap on the pooled nuclear industry's liability in the event of a major nuclear accident.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, you know, the public assumes all financial risk above this cap. There's also, you know, the, as we just mentioned, the federal responsibility for nuclear waste disposal. That's a big, you know, that's a big present a gift to the nuclear industry as far as them taking on that burden. There's also, there's a costly mining and milling cleanups, and that's generally taken up by the taxpayers. And so, as far as, you know, we don't really believe that that's actually, that gives, I guess, a fair shake to all other possible energy sources that could, you know, play out in this. And so we have to, you know, kind of address some of these. There's also the concept of loan guarantees that are given, and there was originally a larger number, and Congress has scaled that back some. And so we're not necessarily opposed to the building of the plants using some of these loan guarantees, but we think that, you know, build them, go slow, and, you know, demonstrate both their economic viability and the reliability and adequacy of their safety systems before you start to promise any new money for this. So.
We're just about out of time. Maybe real quick, I'd ask you about a question that also came up on the program we did the other day, and that is that we have plants now that are operating, that are in operation, and they're past the date when they were thought to have reached the end of their operating life. Is how concerned would you be about a plant that you know, had been, say, thought to be a 30-year plant, just to pick a number, and that is now still going and it's past 30?
I would have to take into account a couple things, which would be the reactor design itself and its safety history. But as to whether or not the relicensing of a plant is a smart decision, I think in some cases it could be, because, you know, it definitely improves the economics for the plant. However, we tend to see kind of it seems very easy for the NRC in some cases to go ahead and relicense this plant, relicense certain plants or grant extensions for plants that maybe don't have the best track record. And in addition to the extensions, they're allowing, you know, things such as power uprates, which allows them to operate even a higher power. And so in the absence of any of these controls and safety requirements that the NRC is recommending in their report, I don't think that we should be moving as fast as we should be, as we've seen on these extensions. So,
Well, just your bottom line then is it's not a technology that you're completely opposed to, but it sounds like you have a lot of concerns about safety, about plant design, about the issue of long term, how we deal with the waste, about the economics. But at the same time, you're not willing to, you don't want to dismiss completely the idea of a nuclear generation?
Not necessarily. We believe that, you know, we're not anti-nuclear by any means, and that we think that, you know, just through a very detailed and correct understanding of the risk and the economics and the viability of these systems, you know, that's the only way that good policy is going to come out. You know, do we really need to be addressing these from a larger, from a higher vantage point? In that, what does the overall nuclear fuel cycle represent, both in terms of an environmental impact or impact safety impact, or economically, whether or not it's economically feasible? So, it definitely has a place. It's just we think that there more needs to be done on understanding some of these aspects to make it a fair assumption.
All right, there we're going to have to leave it. Dr. Jordan Weaver, our guest. He is Project Scientist and Science Center Fellow at the Natural Resources Defense Council within their nuclear program located in Washington, D.C. Dr. Weaver, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.